Thank you, Paul. I want to go one slide back before I begin to say that when one works in a place like that, there is no way but getting inspiration. And I got a lot of inspiration. And being here at UCSB was really a highlight of my last career life. And no, these are anonymous cyclists. That's the title of this slide, actually. And I'm really grateful to David and Dan, who made it possible for all of us to be here, and for Terry and all the other program chairs who did so much to make it beautiful and nice, including providing us with this and taking us for happy hours and so on.
Just a suggestion, put this in your report.
With a picture. The report is going to be very, very positive no matter what. So, origin of life without biopolymers. Dan Hone talked to me today at Coffee Room and said, this is like origin of life without life or without biology. And indeed, this is what it is. But what is it that we are here all for? We are here to try to see how physics gives rise to biology, because we all know that there is nothing else but physics which gives rise to chemistry, which gives rise to biology. And the question is exactly how did it happen? And this is what I'm going to try to spend 2 hours with you today. So in a way, trying to ask about the origin of life is one of the most crucial questions that a physicist can ask about life. Remember all the details, learn all about biology as it is today, but try to understand how it arose. Now, everybody knows that life is associated with this ext entity here on the right, which is DNA. And I started my career in the origin of life by reading Freeman Dyson's book, the new edition of which has just appeared and several of you are reading now. But I read the old edition, and I actually also read another book of his called Infinite in All Directions. I'm happy this worked out with a little one, because we cannot start a talk without him. Is he here? Okay. So I read this book and a chapter in this other book, and it said bluntly that you can begin life without DNA or RNA. And this to me, like to anybody else in this audience, sounded like a complete heresy. How can it be? And I read on and I found out that there was a very clear quantitative solution to this question of how can you start life without biopolymers. And in the last 6 years, my students and I have tried to instill a more and more quantitative content to this notion. So Dyson's book is very quantitative. There is a formula, there is a formulation, and I will not tell you about this today, but we went slightly further than that. And what you see here, blurred on purpose, is what we feel might have been the culprit. The culprit is small molecules, each shown as a spherical colored entity, of course simplified, that make associations with each other, talk to each other, importantly, by the exact same way, exact same forces and exact same notions that we use in biology. Remember, we are not covalent entities. A person or a bacterium is a non-covalent entity. There are polymers, but they are held together by non-covalent forces. Enzyme specificity, antibody and antigen interactions, lipids that make membranes, proteins that bind to DNA, these are all non-covalent phenomena. So we are held together, basically, and we function by way of non-covalent interactions, and this is what happens within this little spherule that you see here, more detail to come. I'm beginning, and all along my talk, there will be a lot of truisms, and you have to please forgive me for that, but I want to go slowly along a track that includes all of these truisms and banal statements so that we really know what we are talking about. Life is complex. It's complex in many different ways, and we have heard for 3 months now about this. Beginning with the molecular level, with all its glory, you look at what happens here. You look at ribosomes, each constituting several dozen proteins and a couple of RNA molecules inside them. You look at tRNAs. You look at how proteins get synthesized. You look at the nucleus and at the cytoplasm with all its organelles. You look at DNA, at RNA, and you have nothing but wonderment. how can something like this arise out of nothing, out of pure chemistry? And most of the texts about the origin of life, basically, at the crux of them, have a miracle. They say there was chemistry, 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 and then RNA and DNA arose, and ribosomes and tRNA and everything, and we will one day tell you how it happened. But it's not easy. And these make cells marvels of complexity with organelles such as mitochondria, such as lysosome, such as the Golgi apparatus, the endoplasmic reticulum here, the nucleus with all that it contains, membrane all around. This is a eukaryotic cell. A prokaryotic cell is simpler. And to our amazement, given about a billion years, or maybe 2 billion years, these cells begin to accrete together and form little guys like this, like Drosophila melanogaster. And you can see this is, because it's small enough to be looked at by scanning electron microscopy, as shown here, you can begin to appreciate how complex an eye is, or this is sort of the nose of the animal, and so on and so forth. And how do you make these together is the realm of developmental biology, but it is far down the line for what we are interested in. We are interested in this terra incognita here that led to this, that led to that, that led to this. Talking about bacteria, I don't know how many of you really know how small bacteria are. Saying that they are about 1 micron across is very nice, but how do you connect it to your everyday experience? This is how. Life, a haystack at the point of a needle. This is I invented yesterday. I thought it was quite nice. So here is the point of a needle. And enlarged about 10 times, you begin to make out the bacteria here, slightly larger and even larger, about 3 microns by 1 micron typically. This is very, very small. And still, inside it, it contains all the machinery, DNA and ribosomes and membrane around and cell wall and all the enzymes, hundreds and thousands of enzymes in a very, very small space. So what it means is that chemistry is very minute and it can cram in very small spaces a lot of machinery. And this is an important lesson. In a volume such as we occupy, a meter cube or something like this, you speak for yourself, Eitan says. Although I would argue about this afterwards at break. So when we have a meter cube, and that's a very small volume for a planet, there are so many bacteria and so many vesicles or micelles from which we think life began, and there are many, many ways that one, the chemistry can experiment. So the transition from the very minute, the molecule, to the still very small, the needle, gives a lesson about how life could have arisen. We have a very nice story that continues here in another slide that I didn't bring with me about how life evolved. Not interesting to us. We ask about here. But there is a lesson here. Evolution can bring from one form to another. It can generate more complex forms from simpler ones. It should have been at work very early on. The question is only, when did it begin? And this is the crux of what I'm going to tell you today. Not life without biopolymers as much as evolution without biopolymers. You can jumpstart evolution without biopolymers. Therefore, it is not impossible that all the wonderful machinery that I showed a few slides ago was a result of evolution rather than a cause for it. So you don't need to make RNA and then let it evolve, as some very prominent people in the field like Eigen and Orgel and others would say. But it is possible that RNA, as we know it today with the four bases and everything else, is a result of a process that preceded it, here in this question mark. And already mentioned, if we found out about the origin of life, I believe that we would understand much, much better our own life. Because there are some principles that emerge by thinking about life at its very early stages that may teach us a lesson about what we know about life today that maybe we wouldn't have been able to learn otherwise. Textbook origin of life. Every textbook. Every person you ask on the street, people know about it. You ask a person, ask your grandmother, how did life begin? Or your mother. Very often the answer is, oh, we heard about these people who sparked gases and got amino acids. This is the origin of life. in the eyes of most people. Believe it or not, you as physicists should reject this outright. This is not the origin of life. This is the origin of organic molecules. That's all. There is nothing in it that says how life began. So the experiment, just to say what it was, Miller-Urey experiment, by now classic, almost 50 years ago, take methane, CH4, ammonia, NH4, H2O, and H2. This is called a reduced atmosphere. And it's crucial for the experiment, and there is an infinite argument about whether or not Earth did or did not have a reducing atmosphere originally, because if it didn't, then this experiment would be wrong. But many people then begin to say, but it could work some other way. But this is not the origin of life anyway. This is how to make some organic molecules by one of many pathways. Please bear it in mind. So textbook then continues and says, because Miller and Urey found, by sparking this and cooling down and dissolving in water, they found some amino acids. They didn't really find nucleotides, but they found a couple of molecules that resembled nucleotides, not in all their glory, with a base and the ribose sugar and the phosphate. This cannot be found. There is no phosphate there anyway. But there is only a carbon, hydrogen, a nitrogen, and oxygen. So they found, actually, this is wrong, something that looks like a precursor for a nucleotide. And then the argument goes, these somehow polymerized to form protein and RNA. There are two problems here. First, an experimental problem. It's very difficult to get the constituents by this method or by any other. You get a lot of organics raining on us all the time, but they don't contain all the necessary ingredients, and definitely not in high enough concentrations. Because as I will immediately stress, what you get originally is a gemisch, is a very complex mixture. So this is one problem. And then polymerization is thermodynamically unfavorable. Putting covalent bonds between monomers is very unfavorable, and therefore the idea that very specific kinds of monomers formed a very, very specific kind of polymer as a prerequisite for life, in my opinion, and in the opinion of several other people around the globe, is absolutely false. And then, by some errors that I call a miracle, this made cells. I would like to take you through a journey that looks at life a little more soberly, and asks the question of how a physicist or a chemist would see a real gradation from chemistry all the way to a cell. And there are three important stages, as pointed out by prominent people like Morowitz. There is a wonderful book that he wrote. I brought it here with me, and people who are interested are welcome to look at it. This is the book. It's called Beginning of Cellular Life. And what one of the ideas that Morowitz coins is the idea of a protocell. Don't rush directly from molecules to cells. Let's see what happens in the middle. And a protocell, as it will immediately describe, is much less than a cell, but much, much more than a collection of organic compounds. Let me say a few words about what an organic compound is. An organic compound is anything that is made by carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sometimes sulfur and phosphorus, and some others, sometimes metals and so on. Can participate in the game. And these molecules today are found mainly inside living organisms. And 170 years ago, people thought that only living organisms can make organic molecules, until Wöhler came up and showed that you can get urea out of an inorganic salt. And this was a sort of a break of a dogma that indeed organic molecules are not a mystery. So they are really not a mystery 170 years later. And they are all around. And the only definition about them is that they are made of atoms that allow for molecular complexity. And I will talk about it immediately. And then these molecules, nothing utterly unusual about them, must have made entities that Morowitz called protocells. And I claim that this transition can possibly be modeled by general physicochemical reasoning, as did Morowitz, as did Stuart Kaufmann, Freeman Dyson, and others. And it was only later, and very importantly, these are capable of some form of evolution that led to the complexity of what some people call the last universal common ancestor. Looking at all life today, it looks exactly the same, almost always same genetic code, same tRNAs, same ribosomes with some variations, membranes, DNA, everything is the same. So people claim, as they look in evolution, and we heard about this yesterday from Walter, you look for forking. You go back and back and back and back, and you say there was some entity, not in one copy, of course, but there was an entity that somehow prevailed on Earth that looked a lot like us, of which we all descend. And this is called Luca. Okay, so to understand how this arose, there is a lot of difficulty, and it requires, this probably requires, as many people say about the origin of life in general, it requires historical molecular evolution scenarios. I will not talk about this today. But organic compounds can form naturally by many different processes: UV radiation, sparks, as we heard from Miller and Urey, in volcanoes. They come in showering on us in comets and meteorites. There are meteorites that are called carbonaceous. They contain up to 10% carbon with a lot of organic compounds. And some of them get burned, but dust that comes from them can settle on Earth, and we get tens of thousands of tons of organic material every year this way. And this was true also originally, or even more true, when we were bombarded by a lot of celestial objects in the first days of Earth. Protocells must have rudimentary self-replication, free energy harvesting, which is important and very often ignored by origin of lifers, and the capacity to evolve, but not necessarily, and I would say almost surely not, RNA or proteins. And it is only at this stage the claim is, and the model says, that these complex molecules and everything else in a cell arose. What is that? No biologists, please, only physicists. Well, it's very simple. This is DNA. This is DNA. This is a double-stranded DNA, 12 mer. You can actually count the mers by looking at the phosphate atoms shown in yellow. So they go around like this, okay? And there is a second strand here. This is what is known as a minor groove. This is the major groove. This is a short segment of DNA, only 12 long. A chromosome would typically be 10 million longer than that in us. And in bacteria, it will be something like a few million bases, so it will be 10 to the 5 longer than that. Sugar, the ribose, shown in light blue, and the nitrogen bases that you can see are stacked here, and these are actually the base pairing between here and there. So this is a 12 mer. This contains about 1,000 atoms, slightly under that. That's very big, and that's only 12 mer. And people actually claim that RNA and DNA got to 100 or 200 before they began to do something, like Jerry Joyce is trying to do, getting an RNA that will make its own copies. It's a very, very large molecule. And I claim polymers are too large, too complex. We need to focus on smaller molecules, which we very often call the monomers. But the monomer is a very ill-defined term. It's a small molecule between a few dozen and a couple of hundred atoms that make polymers in us. But the notion of polymers only arises when we have a real alphabet, when we have only very few monomer types that begin to make long chains that have information in them by virtue of the fact that there is a repeat. We see alanine here, and another alanine down the line, and another alanine, and the same is true for all 20 amino acids or for nucleotides. So the notion of polymer and monomer is only important or makes sense only in view of our own life, but still we use that. Monomers for small molecules, polymers for larger ones. I would call this polymer, even though usually biologists would call it an oligomer. It's only 12, up to 20 or something like that. It's called an oligomer. So present life is totally based on these polymers, covalently strung, very long molecules, thousands upon thousands of atoms heaped together to form glorious structures that can very hardly imagine to have sprung to existence by chance. So the question that we have to ask, not only because we want to do something different from everybody else, but because we're really forced to do so, is, did it really start this way? No questions so far. it's good, because I have a lot of slides, but if you stop me, I'll still understand. So the dichotomy is already mentioned, polymers with a machinery such as this one that allows base pairing, so that if the two strands unravel, they each forms its own counterpart to make replication. Importantly, this will never happen when you only have DNA and bases around. It won't happen. It has to have catalysis, and usually in us, it's always it is catalysis by proteins. So DNA on its own is absolutely dead, and this wonderful machinery is only nice in the context of a cell. Can you make anything that will have a glimpse of the glory of this, that is a capacity to make in some to some degree its own copies without all of this machinery? And the answer is again here, by assemblies of molecules that could, by fission, make copies. Much more about it in a few moments. So here is another scenario. First, we diminish this to its right proportions. It's only one way to begin to make life, to make the molecules. And it's really important, and I don't understand how it happens, that in the 21st century, almost everybody still thinks that this is important. This has its importance, but it's not central, because there are many, many other sources. You get a plethora of small organic compounds. They spontaneously accrete, as I will immediately tell you, to make non-covalent assemblies, a centerpiece of my argument, which then can embody, under some conditions, a catalytic network. And this I colored red, because this is the most important part of the argument. And this comes in Dyson's argument and in Kaufman's and so on. This led to protocells, as mentioned already, which then went on. So this is the alternative to the textbook. So now I will take you through several points of several notions that we have to become familiar with and accept before we take the entire model and try to dissect it and decide whether it's right or wrong. First, the origin of life, a planet-scale random chemistry experiment. We all know about random chemistry. We all know that you can make all possible hexapeptides. That's a classic. And we have heard about things like that before, and maybe we'll hear more. Actually, we will hear more towards the end of the week from Gold and others. So you can make all hexapeptides. How many hexapeptides exist? Quickly, physicists. How many hexapeptides can you make? Six?
No.
No, but this is peptides, Eitan. It's not DNA.
20 letters.
20 letters. And hexa is six long. So you have 20 to the power of six, which is exactly 64 million. You can make a test tube very easily with 64 million different hexapeptides. And then you begin to ask questions that present life asks, such as, here is an enzyme, and I want to make an inhibitor to it. So I somehow confront this enzyme with all 64 million peptides in a realm, experimental realm, that allows me to select the best ones that will bind and inhibit the enzyme. And I get an answer. Peptide number 22,573,212 is the best peptide for this enzyme. This is called random chemistry or combinatorial chemistry. I said 20 to 6. I hope I did. If I didn't, that is an unforgivable mistake. Yeah, 20 to the power of 6. 20 times 20, oh, okay. But originally, this was the name of the game, because if originally amino acids arose at all in high enough concentrations, they would make all possible peptides. So life began as a random chemistry experiment, but this is the bad side, the bad news. The good news is that we had an entire planet and perhaps 100 million years at our disposal for these random chemicals to play games with each other. And from a primordial soup, as shown here, made by Campbell, this primordial soup then somehow led from chaos to cosmos, from disorder to order. When you do the experiment like this, and people have repeated it more and more, you find not just alanine and glycine, which admittedly are in relatively high concentrations, but you find all of these compounds and many, many more. And when you analyze them by a gas chromatography experiment, you get multiple peaks. What Miller and Urey and many people that followed them asked was question number one. Are compounds of life, as we know it, present in the mixture? Answer, yes. Are there biases towards them? Answer, sometime. Sometimes very much not so. But the real question to ask is what is actually formed in such mixtures and many other sources of organic chemicals? And very importantly, how to get from such a mixture to the narrower assortment of present life forms? A digression. If you analyze the molecules of our own life, they are unbelievably stereotyped. Of the billions of molecules, and I will immediately show you that indeed billions can form, that could have formed up to a molecular range of a few hundred atoms, actually more than billions, very, very large number. We only have about 1,000, less than 1,000. This includes the 20 amino acids, the 4 RNA nucleotides, the 4 DNA nucleotides, quite a few sugars, lipids, and some other molecules not to be specified right now. But the total is a few hundred, not more. And they form, by combinatorics, all the marvels of life, by making oligomers and polymers. So there are two processes here on the origin of life. One is narrowing from a huge collection of molecules to a very narrow one that could have happened before, or should have happened before, proteins and RNAs formed, and then carry on. So how do you do the narrowing? The chemistry of CHNOPS, as I call it. Carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. Shown in nice colors here. And these are but very, very few of the molecules that can form. But here are some that you know. Glycine, it's like a Lego puzzle. Taurine, which is an amino acid that you don't know very much. Glutamic acid, you know better. Gamma-aminobutyric acid, and the rest that are shown here, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, and acetylcholine, all of these are neurotransmitters in our brain. But they are small molecules. They are like amino acids. But it only shows you that there is a broader spectrum. We have 20 amino acids in proteins, but there are others, quite a few others, that we have in life, and multitudes of others that we don't have in life. But then there are more complex chemistries, chemistries that are made, say, by mushrooms when they wish to intoxicate us. So you have psilocybine, mescaline, that you may have heard a little more about, and this is the famous LSD. And this is just a small sub-universe of all that is possible. This one has about 24 or 25 atoms other than hydrogen. And just to make the argument, here is this molecule with its oxygen and 3 nitrogens. I depleted this structure of all the color and left only carbon and hydrogen because this is an easy statistics. And it is actually in Morowitz's book, but he quotes others. If you have 24 carbon atoms with hydrogens and you can make branches and rings and so on, I think this calculation is even without rings. But suppose that it is, this small molecule can exist in about 10 million different isomers. Now, when you add what we call the heteroatoms, the colored ones, the sulfurs, then the phosphoruses, and the nitrogens, and so on and so forth, this little molecule could exist in at least a billion isomers, but potentially many more, and I think there are good mathematicians that can do the calculations. So if left or let loose, CHNOPS can generate billions of compounds, and it was so originally. So which substances or systems played the planet-scale random chemistry? Still, the RNA people can make a comeback and say, oh, okay, so there was random chemistry, but it then strung itself into polymers and began the game. But this is now leaving us with a much worse scenario for RNA people, because RNA, for it to function, requires this beautiful base pairing that will only occur for certain chemicals but not others. An alternative scenario is that what we call the lipid world. There are easy monomers, they abound, they are all around. And what is really important, the polymers, quote-unquote, of this system are non-covalent. These are called micelles or vesicles. These form spontaneously and can harbor a lot of interesting chemistries. A few words about how molecules come together by non-covalent forces. They can do so by hydrogen bonds. They can do so by polar interactions. But the most important force in biology, we have to realize, and particularly in a prebiotic scenario, is that which competes very strongly with water. That is, if you have a molecule that makes hydrogen bonds, it can make beautiful hydrogen bonds with the water around. And there isn't so much free energy to gain by putting together two such molecules and forming an intermolecular hydrogen bond at the expense of expelling water. But if you are hydrophobic, as it's called, that is usually composed only of carbon and hydrogen, hydrocarbons, and this is the gas that you fill your car with, or this is mineral oil that you smear on your skin, or petroleum contains a lot of these hydrocarbons, and oil that we eat and drink also has a very important component of this hydrocarbon entity. When such molecules in dispersion in water have a choice between staying alone, each surrounded by water, or coming together like this, they choose the latter. And this interaction, called the hydrophobic force or hydrophobic interaction, is driven by an increased entropy due to disordering of water molecules, as Tanford and others have pointed out. And water gets released from the interface. It's not shown very nicely here, but this tends to order water on its interface. And when some of this ordered interface gets released, you get a gain of entropy, and you get as these oily molecules come together. This is a very important force also in protein folding. We heard about it before. But what is nice about it is that small molecules that are capable of doing this, and particularly, very importantly, if the molecules are extremely hydrophobic, they will form a separate phase, an oil layer. But if they are amphiphilic, that is, they have a hydrophobic water-hating tail and a hydrophilic water-loving head, they will form beautiful structures like this, monolayers at an oil-water interface or at a water-air interface. Micelles that may or may not have some purely hydrophobic oily compounds inside, they can just be tails pointed in and heads pointed out, or a bilayer that will form spontaneously. This is probably the most elaborate lifelike entity that can form absolutely spontaneously from components. And there are many, many molecules that can do the job to some degrees, to better or worse degrees, depending on exactly how long the tail is, how polar is the head, and so on. But this actually makes for better fun, because they will make not only these round structures, they can make all sorts of structures that could become interesting.
What is a lifelike?
Lifelike because we have the exact same structures. In us, if you look inside a cell, there is membrane around, thank you, this is important, and there are vesicles that bud off the membrane and travel around from endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi apparatus to outside, and membrane manipulations are extremely important in life as we know it today. And what is nice, you know, we say when a cell divides, there is DNA that makes its own copy by help of enzymes, but everything else also divides, and membranes don't need to be instructed. You only need to supply the right lipids in the right place, and they will form larger and larger area so as to allow the cell to then undergo fission and make two. So even today, this spontaneous generation of structure is extremely important. Just to make you acquainted with the culprits, these are lipid molecules. This is a very famous one, phosphatidylcholine, also known as lecithin, that is present in egg yolk. And we eat it every day, and some people say it's therapeutic and so on, but it's actually one of the most important constituents of our membranes. There is this thing here looks hydrophobic to you, but inside lurks a positively charged nitrogen atom. I don't think we can make it inside here, but there is a positive charge here, and there is a phosphate group here, like also here. There is a glycerol moiety with three oxygens that is very hydrophilic, and then but it is substituted usually with all, there is one substitution here and two here. These are the two tails, sometimes kink by a double bond, sometimes straight. And originally, they could also be branched, although today we don't see too much of that. Now, some bacteria have very unusual lipids, and there is also some other classes of lipids than shown here. This is the same, only with one leg, one hydrophobic tail, lysophosphatidylcholine. And this is acetylcoenzyme A, which is extremely important in our metabolism of making such lipids. And it contains, believe it or not, a nucleotide up here. And there is two phosphates here, and there is a sulfur here. So this is an unusual lipid, but it only shows how diverse lipids can get. Very many head groups are possible, and also very many tails, as I will immediately say in more detail. Now, present-day membranes are bustling places where most of the business is carried out by proteins, shown here, but also some unusual lipids, glycoproteins, glycolipids here, and so on and so forth. But it's a fluid mosaic system that has a lot of proteins in it, and they are the main business ends of the membrane. But could it have begun a lot simpler by only have lipids, except that the lipids themselves had head groups that contained some of the functionalities of what proteins do today? I have to ask a few questions about the origin of life via lipids. And the first and foremost, are lipids there in the original mixtures? And indeed, lipids are abiotically available. And this was shown by my colleague and friend, Dave Dimmer, and colleagues, and some other people, including the fact that you can dissolve out of a meteorite molecules that are lipid-like. They don't need to be the exact phospholipids I just showed you. Remember, random chemistry. The properties are important, not the identity, the exact identity. But they form vesicles, as shown here, just out of the meteorite. The next point on our agenda is convincing ourselves that while today information is in the hands of nucleotides and polynucleotides, catalysis in metabolic circles such as this one is in the hands of proteins mainly, although sometimes RNA, very seldom, one should point out. And enclosure, so people think, is in the hands of lipids. So usually when you say lipid world, origin by amphipholes, people say, ah, forget it. Lipids are very boring. They can only make walls. They are bricks. They are not entities that are alive. They cannot do catalysis. They cannot undergo replication. Can they not? That's the question. Primordially, lipids could do much more than they do in present days. Now, I want to say that the lipid world scenario is again an example. I want to convey to you the idea of a principle embodied in what we call lipid world. So the idea is that today we have a very nice division of labor, as shown here, and originally, maybe we didn't. So phospholipids and other lipids could have stored information, could have mediated catalysis, could have had to do with energy metabolism, which to some degree they have today. Because, for example, all light harvesting devices, retinal in a bacterial rhodopsin, and chlorophyll in all the green plants outside, is embedded within a protein that is embedded inside the membrane. And originally, it may have had only an association with lipids. And this is very nicely pointed out again in Morowitz's book. Just to pay my dues to say again, combinatorial lipids are possible. I almost said it already, but I didn't show it in all its glory. There can be branches, also longer than shown here. There can be double bonds in different places. And there are two different R's, so you get like antibodies, light and heavy chain, you get much more diversity by doing two different tails. Then glycerol doesn't need to be glycerol, and indeed it isn't. For example, in lipids called sphingolipids in our own cells, it's a different moiety here that connects the guys together. And the head group, and that's important, already mentioned, but I will say it again out loud, it can be any polar charged chemical moiety, including amino acids and likes of them, nucleotides, sugars, etc. You have already seen that there is a lipid with nucleotides. Phosphatidylserine is a lipid with amino acid. And sugars, there are many glycolipids that have up on top of their usual head group sugars attached. So all of this is possible. Now we have to go to, yes?
You mentioned the presence of lipids from the extraterrestrial source, but what about for the Miller-Urey?
You can see molecules such, actually most of the mass in the Miller-Urey experiment was what they called goo. It's black material that precipitates to the bottom and that they could never analyze. It's polymers and it's like tar. And this tar apparently contains some hydrocarbons. Walter, you wanted to ask a question? You don't.
You could have surface catalysis and metals associated. You could have random chemistry from other surfaces.
Thank you for the question. I will not deal with it in much detail, but it's an important point at which I could mention this. For life to have arisen, entities that are self-contained should have been there. That is, catalysis should have been within. And many people say, I mentioned it in one of the earlier slides, that the original catalysis was from surface of clay, of metals, of pyrite, which is important in some of the thinking of people like Werther's, Heuser, and so on. But this is outside the entity. Eventually, and everybody agrees, catalysis should have sprung out of this metal surface and begun to be on its own. And it was at this point, it could have taken some of metal ions with it. But at this point, you have to invoke organic molecules. You don't have to, but it's very likely that this was the case. I have to now, I have to account for several profound questions. If I am to say that lipid assemblies or lipid-like molecules that assemble together by non-covalent forces can replicate, the first thing I have to show is information. Covalently strung molecules contain information, no doubt, by the order of the constituents along the chain. How about lipid assemblies? They don't have an order. It's a system that is undergoing a continuous fluid dynamics. They can switch around. So we claim that the original diversity and therefore information was in composition. It's not really a novel concept, but it's a novel concept en route to the origin of life. Compositional information is everywhere. There is compositional information in a DNA chip. That's how much of each RNA does a cell make. That's a compositional information, no sequence. If you know the composition of a protein, you can tell what it is. There is enough information, provided that you have the entire genome sequence. So if today I take a protein at random out of my own body and cut it into pieces to individual amino acids and count how many occurrences of each kind of amino acid is within this chain, without any knowledge about the order, that's enough to define the protein. Because you can make a quick calculation. For 100 long, there is 100, choose 20 different kinds of ways to make actually, it's not exactly that because there are repeats, but anyway, there is a very large number to make different compositions, and the very few that prevail, the few tens of thousands that prevail in our own body, are absolutely unique. So there is compositional diversity as opposed to sequence diversity. Thank you for the question. Thank you for the comment. I have not claimed. No, even in proteins. I have not claimed that two proteins with similar composition have similar function. Absolutely not. But there is enough, if you know all the 50,000 compositions of all your proteins, and you find a protein and you analyze it by composition only, in composition space, it's narrow enough to define what it is. Actually, because of what you said, because proteins, even if similar, tend to have different compositions slightly. Anyway, it's not that I'm claiming that everything is in composition, but there is enough information there to start us going.
But there we have a master list, that's the genome.
Sorry?
The reason you can tell is because we have a master list, the genome.
Yeah. A master list meaning?
Well, if you look at a composition, you know the differences, how much difference it means.
Right. But what is important now is that we can use compositional information, and a few words about the quantitative aspects of compositional information. Diversity, which actually relates to information, has the same limiting slope for covalent polymers and non-covalent polymers when viewed on an axis that has to do with with how many different chemicals there are. So the number of different types of monomers that exist is ng, and as it increases, of course, we get more and more possibilities, both for sequence and for composition. And Yes, please.
You essentially what you're saying that there are few 10,000 proteins.
Forget about the proteins. This is taking us the wrong way. All I'm saying is forget about proteins for a moment. Okay, I gave it as an example. Thank you for the word. It's an example. Let's forget it. What I'm saying is there is information in composition.
Sure,
that's all.
It's exactly the same like going to a library and saying that every book has its own weight. If the library has 2,000 books, you weigh them. And
yes.
If you go with a fine enough resolution, those two books will have the same weight.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at the weights of the book. Mm-hmm. Will that tell you something about the content? I mean, there is information, but it's not the kind of information for which you go to the library.
What Eitan is saying, bringing ad absurd what I'm saying, is that there are better ways to invoke information. Thank you. That's absolutely right. But what I want to tell you is that there is enough information in the question of how many of each type we have in a bag to begin to get going, and I will say more about it immediately. So,
let me ask you a physics question. Is it known that you can just sort of mix different tails and heads together and it will still form a nice sample?
Yes, yes. A nice, not always, but it. Because people have done that. Actually, our own membranes have several dozen different lipids in them. And bacteria sometimes have even more, and plants have even more. So, you don't want the beautiful things. What you want is a very disordered system. It doesn't have to start with little spherules. All you need is association in all sorts of ways that will form physical entities that are separate from their environment. That's all. They will.
If you throw 50 things together, then maybe they're so small that...
Terry, the big is not a problem. The small is the problem. Big is easy. If you make it just purely hydrophobic, it will make macroscopic droplets.
Yeah, you want to have all these different compositions.
That's exactly right. I'm getting there. Let me try to take you along. But these questions are important. So just to convey the idea that initially, as NG is rather small, the number of different types of monomers, there is much less information in non-covalent assemblies. But the increase of this information with increasing NG becomes asymptotically the same for both types of entities. Right, right. But NG is very large. That's the point I was making with the billions of compounds that CHNOPS can make. So NG can be very, very large. So compositional information, we define it usually as a vector that says how much of each kind, Ni, for a species I, there is inside. For example, N red is 3 and so on. And you can also ask about the relationships among different compositions by a dot product of the two compositions. So they could be orthogonal if you have everything here is not there, and they could be very, very parallel to each other if almost everything that you have there is also here. Now, what is nice, in addition to everything I've already said about lipids and assemblies made of lipid-like molecules, is that, yes?
So if you think of these random, these obvious made of, out of random, a random composition, is it still clear that I should imagine them as sort of fluid, that they move freely around?
Okay.
Or, I mean, that's clear if they're homogeneous. Is it still clear if they're...
I think your question, as well as Terry's, attests to the idea that we are used to what I call school chemistry. We take a particular chemical and ask, what would be its properties? Is it fluid enough? Is it not fluid enough? What is nice about the scenario I'm mentioning here is that, yes, some molecules will not make the good structures. Some molecules will make structures that will not be fluid. But those that make just, there is enough planet to experiment, those molecules that will happen to accrete into assemblies that are fluid enough and contain enough diversity and are small enough and large enough, not two molecules but 1,000, they could jumpstart life. So the question you're asking, the school chemistry question is this chemical good for life? I don't ask this. I ask, okay.
The question was just sort of not even putting a validation on these molecules, just how should I imagine the typical
It there are different temperatures at which it could start. You are talking school chemistry. Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's halfway. Yes, it's halfway. What is important is that there will be enough capacity to exchange molecules. Let's keep it because I'm coming to this. I want to please ask you to forget for a moment what you learned in school. Remember, we are talking about billions of different kinds of compounds and a specific process in which better assemblies could be selected in favor of worse one. Well, Terry, still disturbed.
I think that this group here particularly likes to think about sort of different sort of things forming assembly. It's a so-called disordered system. And typically when you throw lots of different compositions together, they could have a rather different properties from the school kind of a lipid that we think about. So I'm just asking whether the lipid made of these random, sort of membrane made of these random lipid, anything known about experimentally or theoretically?
It's a nice point. Okay. As long as the molecules more or less conform with the stereotyped notion of a tail and a head, everything will depend on the length of the tail, how many tails there are, how kinked they are, and so on. But we are talking random chemistry. We know that some will form such structures and others will form others. So your point is well taken. But about experiments that I will talk about at the end of the second hour, one of the experiments one could do is to explore in a profound way the behavior of assemblies made heterogeneously of many different molecules. Let me try to proceed because this will come to light immediately. Just to mention that among the properties of soft matter that lipid assemblies are endowed with is the capacity, if you look under the microscope, and I have done so, as lipid assemblies form, as they come out of solution, for example, if you take a solution of a fatty acid, just a tail with carboxyl at the end, which under low pH, high hydrogen ion concentrations, will be neutral. So it will form a droplet. No, not enough polarity at the head. But if you go to a higher pH, then the proton will dissociate and you'll get a pure charge at the head. And then they begin to form micelles and vesicles and all sorts of membrane structures. Look at this under the microscope. What you see is a plethora of different structures, some round, some long, and they stream around and they do all sorts of things, including what you see here. They can undergo fission, they can undergo fusion. And again, concerning Terry's question, everything that happens there depends very strongly on exactly what lipid it is. So it opens the way, so to speak, to a lot of possible functional attributes. Now some quantitation about what we are really interested in. I already tried to convince you that there is information in assemblies that are non-covalently associated within them. What about conveying this information, generating progeny? Well, there is a very simple algebra that again is mentioned in Morowitz's book, and we follow suit. And the algebra is as follows. Actually, we extended it to some degree. This is concerning what David was asking. If we have a very large NG and relatively small assemblies, N being how many molecules of any type are within a given assembly. So this could have, let's say, 200 different kinds of lipid molecules, and NG, the universal diversity of molecules around, which accrete to form this assembly. This NG could be a billion, or in a school chemistry, it could be one, like shown here. And it could be somewhere in the middle. Now, if you accrete an assembly at this condition, where N is very small and NG is very large, what do you get? You get an assembly that on average, and even more than on average, actually almost always, with slight fluctuations, will have only one copy of each kind of molecule. Can this breed true by splitting? Answer, absolutely not. Because there is one of each kind, some will go left, some will go right, and you'll get two completely different progeny. Here, trivial. Of course, the progeny will be very nice, but this is also really trivial, because when you take a pure lipid, that's not the beginning of life. But there is an intermediate realm where N is about equal to NG, and actually, if you went to about here, to N equals 2NG, that is, there are two copies of each molecule, then there is a statistics of how well this assembly could split into two progeny that are like each other. Yes? What? Yeah, N equals 2NG, that's what you're saying? Right, thank you. And the question is, therefore, how to move back from N equals 1 NG, that is one copy of each, back into the same as we had here. So this cycle of splitting and breeding sort of true, and then coming back to here by a process that I'm going to define right now, is a very, very important point. And here it is. Yes. Correct. Correct. But if NG is 10 to the 10, which is not unlikely, let's say 10 to the 8 even, many, many, many assemblies are in the range of 100 to a million. So this is a very typical little assembly of the kind of micelles and small vesicles, and this is well below NG. But that's important. And again, my whole argument is, given enough time and enough space, all games can be played. If, by chance, a very large assembly formed, then it won't answer the criteria that I'm mentioning here. So, following David Gross's question, we have to find a way to go back from a small assembly, which again has one of each kind approximately, to a larger one, by way of asking here how to achieve replication capacity, and the answer is by homeostatic growth, time in variable concentrations. Now, cells are homeostatic. If you perturb them by any way, they will try to come back to the original concentrations and some other conditions. Organisms do so for temperature and so on. So the cells, by way of their intricate metabolic network, have a way to keep their concentrations constant. Perturb, and more metabolism will take place to change that back. And we heard about this. This is all about the Lac operon and everything else. So mutually catalytic networks, I'm going to make the argument, could do the job. So I'm going to search for a good stop point. I think I will do it in a couple of slides. That's always true, right? People always want to push a little further into the break. So when you have an assembly, what we ask is that this assembly will be able to catalyze, to undergo some kind of a catalyzed growth to be elaborated in the next hour, so as to preserve homeostatically its composition, so as to reach a point at which if x split into x prime and x double prime, not necessarily equal in size, there will be a propensity for the vector of compositions, bold n, to be approximately equal for progeny mutually, as well as between progeny and parent. And this, I think, is a good stopping point for the break, and I will come back to this after the break.
So I'm really pleased that Walter Fontana is here with us, because he's another pioneer of the notion that that this can actually happen. Now, for many years, mutually catalytic networks, to be explained in a moment, were in search of how they can actually operate by way that will lead to life. There was a hunch, there was a gut feeling that if molecules talk to each other, this is good, that they somehow will lead to something interesting and lifelike. For example, Dyson would say this would lead to quasi-stationary states that are like homeostatic little entities that keep their concentrations more or less intact. Kaufman made a lengthy argument in his book and elsewhere in papers that says that if you have many molecules and they begin to interact with each other catalytically, to be explained a little more in a moment, then you get a closed network, and the network begins to be more and more catalytically closed, as he says, the more molecules you add. To which some people countered, but if you add too many molecules, then everything is lost in dilution. So somehow you have to go back and say, no, there are well-defined networks. Not everything is there. Not all the possible peptides, as in one of the examples of Kaufman, as is depicted here, beginning to be more and more diverse as the peptides become longer and longer, or oligonucleotides. But you need to have something well-defined. Enough for an introduction, because I need to explain what we see here. What is a mutually catalytic network? Actually, the concept is quite simple. Let's try to understand the language of this graph. Circled are what is called foodstuff. That is, some molecules need to be supplied from the outside, no question. Organisms today make all their organics. This guy out there, grass or eucalyptus, makes all its organics from gases, from CO2, with the help of bacteria, from N2, nitrogen, and from water. That's it. And it needs light for that. This is absolute autotrophy. You make all your organics. But most of us animals don't make our organics on our own. We make many, but we consume some. So this is the foodstuff, right here. These are molecules made from foodstuff, pictorially depicted as oligomers, but not necessarily so. So you put A and B together in little strings, but this could be any complex chemistry made out of original molecules that we call the foodstuff. Now, here in this particular depiction, most of the all the reactions are bimolecular. A plus AB makes AAB. So this is the point of reaction where two of these join to make a slightly larger molecule. AAB plus BAAA make this creature at this point. What is important are the red arrows. The red arrows say that there is a propensity, there is a probability for A compounds such as BBA to catalyze this reaction in which B and AB come together to form BAB, and likewise for so many other reactions. So one can ascribe a probability fixed in Kaufman's teachings, absolutely not fixed in our own teachings, that is a graded response, but it doesn't matter. What is important is that if you have enough of these red arrows, then this entire network begins to, so to speak, assume life of its own. Now, importantly, the substances shown here as oligomers can assume any chemistry, and this is very clearly stated by the students of this field. They need not be oligomers. So any chemistry will do the job. We applied this notion of catalytic networks to our own system under the auspices of what we call the graded autocatalysis replication domain. This is nice for an acronym, but it's somewhat misleading because it's not really autocatalysis, it's mutual catalysis. So, but the whole system is sort of autocatalytic. The entire network is autocatalytic. So here is how it applies to our little assemblies. In the simplest embodiment of applying a catalytic network concept to lipid assemblies, or amphiphil, as we call them, amphiphil assemblies in a more general way, the reaction that happens is just joining. This is utterly simple. No synthesis. So this is what we call complete heterotrophy. You use all your molecules from the outside, but let's see what you can do with them. So you have a sea of molecules around you, and you begin to accrete, and there is a reaction for each color species. There is a forward rate to go in and a backward rate to go out. Joining an assembly is a reaction just any other. It's just like the association of a substrate with an enzyme or anything like that. The molecule has to sort of push its way into the assembly. It interacts with certain molecules on the side as it does so. It can be better at doing so. It can be worse. And very importantly, it can be helped by friends to do so. So the entry can be catalyzed by some other molecule. This is completely different, and it's important that I should stress it right away. It's different from the thermodynamic concept of molecules like each other. Where is Terry? I need his question. So the molecules can like each other thermodynamically. This you're talking about here. Right. The red arrow is exactly like Walter Fitch is saying, exactly, that this molecule can change the rate by which this greenish guy can change the rate by which purple comes in, and it does so, importantly, by the laws of thermodynamics, equally well, both ways. So it doesn't change the equilibrium constant. The equilibrium constant has its own game to play, and it could be different for different molecules. But what is extremely important for our model is the way by which the kinetics is affected. That is, how molecules affect each other's rate of entry. So, we have spontaneous.
So you started from a concept which was purely thermodynamic, right? It's this formation of micelles and so on. That was a...
Yeah, here, this is the blue. Spontaneous downhill assembly. So there is a force, a free energy gain by entering this assembly because of the hydrophobicity and so on. But modulating that, the growth is catalyzed, or the joining is catalyzed by some other molecules, and in a more general case, it could be also synthesis that would be catalyzed. Is this, have I made myself clear here?
Well, you've done, if I
pure thermodynamic equilibrium, then I would have a sort of this aggregation, and maybe if it's too big, the diffusion and things like that. So I have a distribution of sizes and then composition. Both are very broad. Okay, and now
if there is catalysis, something very interesting happens. So, correct. But you, Henry, is exactly a system like that. At equilibrium, you're dead. And catalysis is what makes you a sort of a vortex in chemistry space be different from what equilibrium would prescribe. Yes? No. It will become apparent very soon. Yeah. There will be a steady state established away from equilibrium. And it will, of course, require the input of external energy.
Yes.
Jean-Marc. Okay. It depends on the concentration, what is known as the critical Mises concentration. At relatively high concentrations, most of the molecules will be in assembly. So amphiphilic molecules typically, if you have them at concentration of 1 millimolar, for example, total in a volume, in a liter of water, then most of the molecules will be in assemblies. So it's favorable. Right. What I'm pointing out is that despite the fact, as always, with every chemical reaction that we consider, there is a difference of free energy, and there can always be a mountain that you have to overcome en route to exploiting this free energy gain. And it is this mountain that can be lowered by this molecule onto that molecule to join. Now, what is implied here is that lipids exert catalytic powers on others. And one of the questions we need to ask very quickly is, can they do this at all? This is a question that many people ask, because mostly in our present life, there is no catalysis by lipids, although in some occasions there is. And as a means of talking about biology in general, as a tool for understanding the origin, I want to digress for a couple of slides into what is enzyme catalysis, because maybe we haven't heard enough about this, and it's important that we mention this. Catalysis, after all, is just the right chemical groupings in a correct rigid orientation. This allows concerted chemical action that lowers the activation energy. This is my own definition. It's very clumsy, but it works. So here is a protein. And shown here are two different entities. There is a serine group here and a histidine group here. This is the imidazole of histidine, and this is just a simple OH group. Now, the vicinity of these two makes for a different set of characteristics for this OH. So this vicinity is important. If this histidine were to be allowed to diffuse away, as it would happen if it was on the surface of a lipid micelle, then life would be much harder. So proteins are marvels of juxtaposition. You put together these two groups in just the right angle, and it will do wonders. Such as, for example, this is a polypeptide that approaches. This is one of the peptide bonds that need to be broken. This is the rest on left and right. And when this approaches, this happens. That is, there is an adduct here, a temporary intermediate, a transition state. And then what happens is, miraculously, this covalent bond here breaks, and a new covalent bond is formed. So this part is already released. The other part of the protein to be broken at one point is attached to the enzyme. This is an intermediate, which then, because the histidine is around, this protein that was transiently attached is eased away, and it diffuses out, and you retrieve the enzyme in its original conformation, except that now the peptide originally here, or the protein, is now in two pieces. One piece that already went out here, and another piece that goes out there. Now, what is the lesson? The lesson is, all you need is a histidine and a serine near each other in the right orientation. Can only proteins do this? No. Anything that will put the right groupings in the right place will do. So the whole idea of the sacred proteins as the carriers of catalytic capacity is utterly wrong. So proteins are not the only one. Enzymemetics, anything that does the job in the right way can do it, including under some conditions, although transiently, although fleetingly, groups that are on the surface of micelles, as so nicely depicted by Lipovsky in Germany, showing that a mixed micelle can look a lot like a folded protein. Green hydrophobicity inside, red water-loving groups on the outside, and the only difference is that a heterogeneous lipid micelle is a little bit like a disconnected folded globular protein. But it could have enzyme-mimetic properties. This is a statement of general chemistry, no mystery in catalysis. Now, today, inside lipid bilayers, there is a lot of action going on. Lipids get made and broken. Lipids can affect enzymes by way of being allosteric modifiers. Lipids can undergo catalyzed insertion, exchange, and leaflet flipping. They can go from one leaflet to another by an enzyme called flipase. So lipids are substrates very often. But can they be enzymes? Well, they cannot be really full-fledged enzymes with all the capacity that proteins entail, but they can have some rudimentary capacity to catalyze reactions. And this is shown very nicely in a book by Fendler and Fendler, in which they actually brought together an assemblage of a lot of instances in which lipids exert catalysis. Very often, the lipids exert catalysis because molecules that enter into the micelle find themselves in a different milieu. And that's only a very general effect. But there are also much more specific effects. And what you see here is actually a preview of something I will show you immediately. And that is that if you plot the capacity, the strength of catalysis, as a probability histogram, very strong catalysis is, of course, very rare, but it becomes more and more prevalent the less strong catalysis you require. So very mediocre catalysis is rather prevalent. This is something that is known as catalytic potency distribution, and I will say more about it in a moment. Even more lifelike and relevant to life are the experiments by Luigi Luisi, that has for many years now has shown beautiful experimental design that do basically the following thing. Here is a molecule that does not form micelles. It is, for example, an ester or an anhydride. Actually, this is an anhydride. The green is, the details don't matter, but the green is a charged molecule, a charged group, carboxyl group, that could, under certain conditions, dimerize so as to eliminate the charge. But if hydrolyzed by water or under some other condition, it will give rise to two pure green, which are charged, and therefore amphiphilic, and therefore make assemblies such as vesicles and micelles. Now, what does this show? As a function of time, if you start with pure such molecule, which is a drop of oily substance on the surface, you are not going to get anything.
Sorry. Just my mistake. So you lost much of my talk? Is it still showing? Oh, I never turned it on. Why? Is it on? No. Should it turn it on? Right. No, actually. Uh-oh. So what do you want to do?
Vesicle-forming molecules. So the end result of that is an autocatalytic process by which once enough micelles have formed, there is a jump along the time axis of a very strong, very fast reaction in which many, many more micelles form. So this sort of phase transition is affected by the fact that lipids, in some way, yet to be determined, exert catalysis on the hydrolysis.
Or lipid-like molecules exert catalysis on the hydrolysis that lead to their own formation. So, thanks. So, this can happen also in a very heterogeneous mixed micelle scenario, either by a modification that is really covalent or just by the joining. Now, we have a system in which we can write the equations, and we do, and we simulate this, for entry of these molecules into the micelles or assemblies, and for the catalysis. But in order to do a good simulation, we need to obtain from somewhere values for this matrix, which says how much an ith molecule will exert a catalysis on the joining or synthesis of the jth molecule. How do we obtain these values? And this goes back to, for those that have been here, to the model that I described in the previous lecture, which is called the receptor affinity distribution model. And it was originally thought about for a system, such as I mentioned before, of these 64 million peptides that are out there trying to bind to an enzyme or to some other target. And we have come up with the idea that one can somehow quantitate the curve of propensities of how often do you get a very strong binding. This is now jumping back to just binding, not catalysis, but it will become relevant in a moment. So there is a very strong binding by this guy here, medium binding here, somewhat less and less binding, and quite a few molecules that will bind almost at background. Now, this I called the receptor affinity distribution, and it says that in principle it can be either experimentally or theoretically been brought to light how many in a given collection of 64 million or so, as any number here, how many will have a particular affinity power. And shown here is also that you can use the same for catalytic power. So people that make artificial enzymes do experiments in this realm of trying either many substrates for a given enzyme, or it's completely symmetrical and you can try many enzymes for a given substrate. In both cases, you'll get a distribution where very good fidelity is rare, and the lower fidelity becomes higher and higher, and sometimes you get a decrement like this. We think that this distribution generally follows something between a binomial distribution and a Poisson distribution. So one can then use in the simulations a matrix that is derived from the idea that for each molecule, this is the same collection here and there, but only shown that this molecule relates to all of these by way of the distribution mentioned, and likewise for anybody else. So you can construct the entire matrix. This is important. This is actually what led me to the direction of the origin of life, because I first developed the receptor affinity distribution model, then read Dyson's book and later other people's writings and teachings, and then I decided that maybe this model for probabilistic interactions can be applicable to an origin of life scenario. And indeed, it took us quite a long way, because you can start with molecules that you know nothing about, just a collection of randomly defined molecules, and begin to instill actual quantitative values by way of this distribution. So what the computer does is it defines molecular entities. It then selects at random, but out of a distribution, the beta values. So strong values will be rather rare, and weak values will be more prevalent. And the exact shape of the distribution is extremely important for what ensues. So again, the definition that we had before, NG, number of different kinds, NI, count of each molecule, total number of molecules, assembly size. And then this is a simple, relatively simple equation in which you have spontaneous rate of going in and out of the assembly, plus times something plus the catalytic enhancement. So there is a whole network. It's a network, a very, very simple network. And the question is, how does it behave? Well, a few items that came out quite nice and clear are the following. If you start from a collection of molecules in a soup, so to speak, and they begin to assemble, even if you assume, and this is important for the question that Jean-Marc asked, even if you assume that all have the exact same thermodynamic values, that is, they all like each other in the same way as far as equilibrium is concerned, if there is a catalytic effect, which is different for the different molecules, you begin to see some kind of selection. Now, this selection only occurs as long as the system is kept, by ways that I'm not disclosing right now, out of equilibrium. If you let equilibrium prevail, then everything falls into boredom. What happens is that if you somehow tweak the system out of equilibrium, then some molecules will begin to show this network of strong arrows towards each other. And by virtue of the fact that each of them enjoys a different measure of catalysis from its neighbors and friends, you get different concentrations for different molecules. So some molecules will be very unfavored and others will be more favored. At equilibrium, they all become equally distributed within the assemblies. So what happens is that away from equilibrium, you get a biased distribution of composition in, or biased composition inside the assemblies. You're talking about here? Okay. Here is a little bit of an anthropomorphic kind of attitude that we always have. I too. Me too. We always want to see inside the network how it works. Is it a cycle? How does it really... But when you have thousands of different kinds of molecules, it's a forest that you cannot untangle. But just pictorially, it looks like a cycle. But actually, there can be all sorts of topological relationships in this arrows. Oh, you're asking about symmetry? Why does this help that, but not this that?
Yeah. Okay, so that's fine. If that's what it implies, that R helps, that if the red helps the yellow, but not vice versa, that's fine.
Yes?
I can understand that. That still leaves the question, is it possible for you to have such a network of three things, with one of those arrows being at the other end of the...
Yeah, okay. It's an interesting question. It can be explored in much detail as to exactly what is the topology of arrows within a successful catalytic network. But I'm going to leave this for a discussion later. The point is that if you have many molecules, the computer says these are the molecules that, as shown here, these are the molecules that prevail. That is, this molecule and that and that and that, out of the gemisch, become more prevalent. And this is exactly what we were striving for. That is, the catalytic network allows each molecule represented only once to go by virtue of mutual catalysis, by virtue of some kind of a club that helps others of the same kind join it, become two of each kind, therefore replication worthy. So you see, this is a compositional graph. How much of each kind? The kinds are here. So some of the kinds begin to show higher concentrations in those assemblies.
Can I see your equation again?
Yes.
The beta ij are all positive?
Yes.
So the solution that you have a steady state has no dependence on beta?
No dependence on betas.
That's
no. I think... Well, it does have dependence on beta. Actually, if you set all betas to zero, then you get nothing. That is, there is no steady state. There is just everything tends to... Well, if you set beta to zero and you switch off whatever keeps the system away from equilibrium, which is actually a disruption, I should tell you that, disruption of assemblies on occasion, as well as division, which we introduce in a moment, then if betas are set to zero, what you get is just a... If there is no catalysis, then you get this. No, you don't even get that. Because this change, which is of different rate here, is purely due to catalysis. So then everybody will follow just the red line, and you get a sort of an equi-concentration system. We should discuss this more because I want to try to convince you in a more qualitative fashion that, although I will show you the results of some simulations, that indeed, if you start, this is relevant to what I was asked in the first hour. This line is the line of spontaneous generation. That is, if you put, we should discuss the dynamics separately because it's extremely important.
If you put back the equation, I think I understand what Mehran is bothered by. And if you just put back the equation, what Mehran is looking for is a steady state where dNi dt equals zero. And if you have something positive multiplying something else, then the only way that it can vanish is that something else vanishes. And is that, does that summarize your point of view? So I think the answer is that this equation does not have a steady state.
Not a true steady state.
Not one that depends on this beta. I mean, it has the one with the free factor vanishes. That's true. But I think that what he will eventually show is that this thing grows in time, and then he will divide it. And this combined process will have something which will look like a steady state. But the equation, if you just put it there,
that is correct.
I will show the exact
dependence, and it will come to light. I think you're right.
Put back the equation for a moment. So I mean, this is the point which I guess we can understand. I
mean, no, but
look at the equation. Leave it up.
Okay. Yeah, no, I understand what you say. I want to show you what the behavior is like, and then it will. This is the behavior. Okay. As long as there is no splitting. So what happens is that indeed, if time is allowed, you get something like that, which is very boring. But as a transient, some compounds, and this is stochastic also, remember, we are talking about individual molecules. So stochastically, some molecules will enhance each other's propensity kinetically to enter the assemblies, and you get something interesting happening, ups and downs and different compositions before it all settles, as long as there is no splitting into an equi-concentration state. Let me say a few words about this because this is important. You start, and I will go back to the behavior that I know bothers the physicist. Again, just going to the intuitive part of it. If you make assemblies spontaneously, where this is assembly size, and this is how many different kinds, there is a third entity defined here. Remember, Ng was the total chemistry, how many molecules in general exist. N is assembly size, that's easy. Ni, the intricacy, defined by Morowitz again, is how many types are actually represented within a given assembly. And as you begin to go this way, this is the realm in which there is one of each kind. So there is sort of a slope of one, although it's not the same scale here. And then as you go, there is asymptoting because you cannot get more kinds that there are in the chemistry. Now this cannot lead to life on its own. You have to somehow move it from a situation in which there is one of each kind down to what we call the Morowitz boundary, where N is about equal to Ng, well, you can begin to see something useful and interesting happening. This is the boring realm in which the number of types is very, very small, almost even one, in a given assembly, so we are not concerning ourselves with that. So the question is how to go along this arrow, selection through catalysis. And then afterwards, we claim at this point, and I haven't said this out loud yet, at this point, you can begin to see some form of selection, therefore, some form of evolution. So what do we see in our computer simulation? Already mentioned, this is the size of the assembly. So the assembly goes to a certain size that is dictated by how many molecules are outside. It's an equilibrium phenomenon, and it will determine the size at equilibrium. By the way, I have to mention that Kim Snappen got hold of our paper, and he immediately wrote his own program to simulate this, and I was very delighted, and he even got results that are somewhat different from ours, and we discussed this over time, but this is part of the beauty of being in a place like this. At Weizmann, no one took our equations and immediately wrote a program, so I'm very glad that someone did it here. So it shows that maybe there is some value in it. So. What you see here is that at each point you can do, at each vertical line, you can ask what does the compositional vector look like. So there may be a medium amount of this, a lot of that and that, and very little of some other colors and so on. So you do the simulation, and what
it grows into a regime in which N is much, much bigger than NG, right?
This
it's not
it's sort of not much much this is in this is actually almost the same. Oh, in time. At this point, yes, at this point, n becomes much larger than mg in a particular simulation.
So for your scenario to work, it has to be
right.
Between about time to the third, okay. The other one eventually dies.
Okay, so what we introduce now is some kind of an energization, which in our biology happens by ATP, but of course we don't have any ATP. And what is really interesting is that you can have energization in a very mundane form. Just a physical force that will disrupt the vesicles or micelles. And this is now the size. It fluctuates. It goes up and divides, up and divide, up and divide. And when you they divide, then this initial realm begins to prevail all along. But...
You do that by hand? How do you get it to divide?
Oh, yeah, you do it by hand.
You do it by hand?
Yeah, you do it by hand. But in a probabilistic fashion. You say if you get to a certain size, you have a certain propensity to divide, and not necessarily equally for the progeny.
I see. So in the computer program, it says when you reach a certain size, if you want it roughly like ng.
Yes. It's one of the parameters of the simulation. What is the size at which the vesicle begins to be uncomfortable with its size and it divides?
And that answers Samira's question.
That is basically, yeah, I think it does. Okay. So this is what we see. This is an autocorrelation plot for the H function, which is the scalar product of two compositions. These are normalized compositions. And what you see is red for parallelism and blue for orthogonality. And you can see that for the first 20 time spots, there is a rather strong similarity between what happens at, say, time spot 12 and time spot 18 and so on. The same is true between 20 and here. Here there is not so much. I mean, this is a little less so. And here, again, there is a very strong sort of prevailing composition. And each of these compositions stays for a while, but then gives way to some other composition. And this is mainly because of the stochastic nature of the simulations, because we are dealing with relatively few molecules. So one can look at these metastable compositional states, or as we nick them, composomes, and there are different ones. You can see that this is different from that by being blue here. But very often, as you'll see immediately, we get repeats of the same composome, and we can ask about statistics of how often do we see a given composome, and so on. The composomes, each of them, is identified as a particular network of interactions among the molecules and as a particular composition. And the compositions are different, and the networks are different. So there are, these are not exact solutions. This is all stochastic chemistry. But there is some relationships between eigenvectors of the beta matrix and what we see here as compositional vectors. And you can play the game with many such assemblies in one go, and you can show how, as they divide, all what I've said before has to do with looking at just at one assembly. But if you look at many, you can see a fate, sort of an evolutionary fate, of how a purple type of composition becomes green, giving way in time to blue, purple coming back again briefly but dying out. On the other hand, another lineage behaves differently, and it shows, I would say, lifelike properties. So what we see here is that just by having molecules that accrete together, mutual catalysis invoked, and splitting, you get relatively interesting behavior.
In your introduction, you said NG, the number of different tiny molecules can be very, very large, like 10 to 8, and I think it's 10 to 10.
And here I used 100.
Yeah.
I don't. With the computer time available to us right now, with the effectiveness of our algorithms, we cannot do very large NGs, but we are thinking of ways of doing that. Actually, a new batch of graduate students, much of this was done by Daniel Segre, who came actually from physics, from Italy, and did beautiful, beautiful work with me. He's now gone for a postdoc at Harvard, and I have two new students who actually just try to do that. See how we can optimize the algorithms so as to go to higher NGs.
Right, but in physics, when we do modeling, right, there's often some theorem that tells us that something
some kind of a, what happens if it asymptotes to very large energies. I cannot answer this question, but it's very interesting.
Doran, you said there's a relationship between
go ahead.
The kind of composites and the composites
well, at least, yeah, well, Daniel has been able to show a formal similarity between a behavior of a quasi-species and the behaviors that we see here. And he showed that at least the largest eigenvalue, or the eigenvector with the largest eigenvalue, is related to what is the most prevalent composome that one gets. But this kind of analogy breaks down, and it's also a crude approximation, because in order to show this, you have to ignore the Beck rates. And this is something that you can do, but you have to be tenuous about it. Okay. This is actually, as NG scales, we don't have yet a feeling for that. But this is what happens with a particular NG, and you can see that different behaviors ensue. So the lifetime of composons, as well as the number of them, may be different for different values of the beta matrix, even though they are always derived from the same distribution. And what we have analyzed in quite a bit of detail, actually this is, in a way, answering the question of what happens with increasing NG, although it's in a very small realm, so it doesn't really answer Tony's question. And this is, nmin is the split parameter. That is, it actually has to do with how big this assembly is before it splits, and to what size does it typically split. But what this graph is actually intended to show is that no matter what you do with NG and with a split size, if the distribution of kinetic constants, of rate enhancement constants, is normal, you get practically no real interesting behavior. While if it is log normal, you get quite a bit of this behavior. So, and what is nice is nature is actually log normal. That is, the rate constants are likely, based on what we know about affinity distributions, the rate constant distributions are likely to be log normal, and that is because it's the energy that is distributed normally. So I'm getting towards the end, and that's also just the right time. All of this is described in papers that are on our website. I will show the website at the end again. So this is the left side, is the classical, as I call it, textbook scenario, where there is chemistry that first funnels into polymers of perhaps one kind, maybe nucleotide kind. Then somewhere along the line, they, as many textbooks would say, get encapsulated by lipids, which, because everybody agrees that encapsulation is important. I haven't stressed it well enough, but encapsulation is something that without which you cannot get evolution, because you need to have identified entities that give rise to progeny, and this is most likely happening by way of enclosures. Then proteins in this scenario somewhere along joined the track to form, usually in their scenario, it goes directly to LUCA. That is, it goes somehow to the cell like we have today. While in our more graded, more, I would say, a little more realistic, more down-to-earth kind of scenario, we have assemblies that form, and then by way of mutual catalysis, they tease themselves out of the random composition, out of the realm of having only one kind of one copy of each kind of molecule inside assemblies, into replicable compositions that then, as Darwin has taught us and many others following him, if you have anything that shows diversity, any capacity to make somewhat faithful progeny, then evolution can begin and you can become more and more complex.
How does the outside become all yellow?
Oh. Yeah, it's just a picture. Sorry.
But you started out with some more than that. Like,
you're right. Many. Okay, there is a transition between a filled ball to an empty ball, which is vesicle. And maybe this transition was affected by the fact that some molecules that got recruited, this is something I have not said, but maybe it's a good time to say that. Many molecules can make balls, but not all molecules will make bilayers like this, that has a hydrophobic inside and hydrophilic inside on both sides with watery fluid in the middle.
Right, so that is difficult. You have to get water inside.
Well, that's easy. That's easy. Yeah, this happens all the time. If you just mix lipids together, they will form some enclosures quite easily, depending on the kind of molecule. But what it shows is that maybe some molecules got selected that favor quite strongly the formation of a shell, and some others assumed other functions. Everybody then asks me, well, what about proving this? And the question is, what constitutes proof? And in this, I'm your humble servant. I mean, you can tell me what constitutes proof.
Doran, can I go back a little bit to your computer simulation? In your computer simulation, your beta ij are all positive, right?
Yes.
And if you make some of the beta ij negative, is there negative catalysis? Would that change
things? We have entertained this, but not really done it. Negative means that a molecule will decrease the synthesis or the joining of another molecule below its spontaneous rate, which is okay. It can happen. And you're asking what kind of more interesting dynamics can exerted by doing this. Okay. We didn't do that, but I take it as something that we should go on for. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about my philosophy about experimental evidence for something as grand and as unattainable as the origin of life. First, there are quite a few other phenomena as shown in the center of this graph that we cannot really do again or cannot do at all, like formation of galaxies, like the first few 10 to the minus 15 seconds of the Big Bang, and so on and so forth. But we can do it in our computers. So my claim is that it is very likely that the origin of life will very strongly depend in the next decade or two on computer simulations. And we will somehow have to learn to cope with this, because we experimental people are very strongly biased by the idea that if you cannot show it in the test tube, then it doesn't exist. But of course, there are some other phenomena you cannot show in a test tube. What? Okay, this comes to here. I put this one because I think that this is going to become very big. That if people want to understand this part of organics to protocells, not the next one. The next one will require a lot of experiments, but again, I don't know how to do them. But the first part, I think, can be somehow rationalized by doing a lot of computer experiments. And we call them computer experiments. We actually do the experiments, that's just like many others, that look at how an atomic bomb explodes in a computer, or how the moon was formed by a Mars-sized object that collided with Earth. Very difficult to do this experiment again, but you can still try to do it in a computer and get quite a few important insights. Or even a small object, like the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. You can simulate exactly what happened and ask questions about that, about the parameters. So this is a realm that I think is going to be extremely important. Large-scale computer simulations, because it's a planet-scale process, because it took millions of years, it is likely that a lot of the important parameters of this process will never come to light by doing test tube experiments. No matter how long we wait, we cannot wait millions of years. And maybe that's important. And then, after all, it is, as Walter Fontana is saying, it is possible to do experiments, but we have to bear in mind that we will have to look at individual assemblies, so do ultra-micro analysis of individual assemblies on a very large-scale experiment, like maybe a whole room filled with assemblies, and large duration, maybe a little longer than the time of a postdoc or a PhD student tenure. And then what we do in astronomy is we do galactic travel with our own eyes. I mean, we look at the galaxies, at their mass distribution, at the luminosity distribution. We look at spectra that tell us about isotope distributions, and so on and so forth. And we get nice evidence. We look at background radiation, at the homogeneity of background radiation, and so on. And we get good evidence for a particular model of Big Bang. Maybe we can do the same, but it's rather difficult. We cannot do much spectroscopy. We can find organic molecules in space. We do it every day. That's easy. But to find the next step towards protocell from far away is going to be very difficult. But there is a spacecraft going to Titan, a moon of Saturn that has apparently oceans of methane. People are thinking about Europa that may have a water ocean under its crust, under its icy crust. One day we will get there. And the question is, by doing galactic travel, what should we expect? Is someone going to walk towards us and shake our hand? Not likely. Are we going to see a tree or a worm or a butterfly? Not likely. Are we going to see chemistry that is like ours? I say, unless there is panspermia, and this is not an impossibility, that life travels through space and seeds itself in new planets. We'll talk about this at coffee break or whatever, or over lunch. Unless this happens, life will be idiosyncratic at each point. So if we bring all our instruments, like PCR machines and enzymes that are used to look at molecules that we know, they will be completely useless. What we will do, we'll have to do again microanalysis and ask specific questions about principles. Is there a biased chemistry? Do we see more monomers, some monomers at higher concentrations and some others not? Do we see any dynamic process? Do we see any frozen dynamic process that indicates that there was dynamics, but it got killed by frost or something like that? All of this is important for a would-be galactic traveler. And I think at one point, some of our models might become quite useful for people at NASA that currently are developing probes usually to look for what life is today here on Earth like, while maybe they should do it a little differently. But we have one snippet of would-be extraterrestrial life that came to us with the ALH-084 meteorite that is of well-defined Martian origin. This is quite well established. And inside, there was this, which was most, I would say, most appealing to people who are interested in form, although there was something else there, which most people ignored, but to me was most extremely important, and that is that there was a biased chemistry. Some polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons were much more prevalent than others. So this could indicate a process like I have described of narrowing the monomer spectrum before getting to the next step of making something more lifelike. But are these lifelike? Are these worms or little things, are they complete artifacts, or are they as an indication of extracellular life, extraterrestrial life? Well, one of the strongest arguments target against this picture is this is too small. Too small for what? It's too small to be a bacterium. And this, in the good scientific literature, was used as an argument that this could not be alive. But does life have to be the size of a bacterium today? If it's simpler, if it's en route to becoming a bacterium, it could be 1,000 times smaller in volume. So this is true also for the fossil record on Earth. We always look for something that looks like our own life. And an important lesson is don't. So I don't say that this is alive, but I say if you use the argument too small, I don't accept it. And finally, thanks to my colleagues. First and foremost, Daniel Segre, mentioned already, Daphna Ben-Eli, the two new students that I have now, Barak Shenhav and Ron Caffrey. Tzachi Pilpel, who did some other work that I mentioned in a previous talk on olfaction, was an important pioneer in this field. He started the very, very first simulations. And OAKEDEM and David Dimmer were very nice collaborators for me. And for the receptor affinity distribution, I'm mentioning these two names that I've already mentioned last time. Thank you.